turned to herself, looking over the cliff's edge into nothingness. There was no sound of body meeting rock. The fog was too thick to see where Thomas found his final rest. All was silent besides the persistent waves and the steady clunk-clunk of the dinghy battering the rocky shore. She turned back to the man, breathing hard, hair in her eyes.
"Is it resolved?"
His dark stare was relentless. Sigrid began to walk toward him, when pain exploded in her belly. She passed a hand over her stomach. It came away wet with blood. In her shock, a partially chewed cot leaf fell from her mouth. Sigrid blinked and saw the bright arc of sky. She blinked and saw her hand coated in gore. She shut her eyes, mind spinning.
"Is it resolved?"
the man repeated.
"Have you chosen?"
Daring to open her eyes, Sigrid saw one thing clearly. The magical flame dancing at the sorcerer's feet. It cast no shadow, nor emitted any heat. It was nothing more than a trick, a figment of something real, created to give meaning to something abstract, subconscious. And on it would flicker, until the sorcerer had no more need of it. Thomas's body had made no sound, as insubstantial in death as it had been in life. Just a figment of Sigrid's whim. She drew up, the pain in her stomach melting away. The iron stake still lay in the crabgrass, but Sigrid splayed her fingers. No blood or markings remained. She stretched her neck and took a breath, feeling full, buoyed, whole. "It is done."
"Good,"
the man said. He turned, beckoning her to follow.
"Then we can begin."
Sophia Lee's Villain Challenge to Sarah Enni. A Dark Sorcerer's Motives for Seeking Immortality or Omnipotence. "Will the Real Villain Please Stand Up?" by Sophia Lee. I don't like villains. Not because they're evil or because they're universally unpopular, but because they're weak. And I don't mean weak in terms of physical strength or magical power, but that they're weak in their characterization. So I asked Sarah to create something, or someone, different. My villain goals for Sarah. 1. A villain so compelling I would question rooting for the protagonist. 2. A villain with comprehensive backstory. 3. A villain with incredible power and a desire to use it. 4. A villain whose moral code was debatable. 5. A villain who would make me reconsider what it means to be a villain. And so Sarah created Sigrid. Sigrid was a character that left me feeling both satisfied and conflicted. How Sigrid does villain right? 1. She wanted to know the limits of her strength. 2. She was focused and determined. 3. She didn't want to waste her potential. 4. She discouraged complacence. 5. She was talented and powerful. Ways Sigrid set off all the wrong alarms. 1. Her interests were only for herself, not for the greater good. 2. She was tempted by, and succumbed to her thirst for, power. 3. She believed she murdered her best friend. 4. And felt no remorse about it. 5. And considered no other options. Sigrid's character resonated with me so much that I wondered what it revealed about my own character. Yikes. Although I could see telltale signs of evil in Sigrid's actions, I could also easily see myself making similar decisions. It made me realize how much the line between hero and villain could be blurred. I've always been the protagonist of my own story, but it's interesting to think I could be a villain in somebody else's. Somebody out there has tried to attain or achieve something, and I have stood in their way. To an extent, we're each an encapsulation of both protagonist and antagonist, hero and villain. Sarah highlights the flexibility of these roles with Sigrid alone. Sigrid was ambitious, yes, and the immensity of her power was virtually inarguable, but she was also intelligent and relatable and, most importantly, comprehensible in her motivation. She stood in a gray field of ambiguity, and upon finishing the story, I discovered with welcome surprise that I wasn't entirely convinced that Sigrid was our villain. I easily adopted the perception that she was solely a determined girl whose only crime, if even that, was that she wanted to see just how far she could push herself. That's not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I do it every day at school. Of course, she also mercilessly murdered someone who turned out to be unreal, and I, for one, don't do that at school, at least not every day. But even though Sigrid was cold and ruthless, she also felt reasonable, to a degree that leaves me wondering, who is the real villain in this story? Not only did Sarah leave me with questions about the ethical boundaries that restrict our fictional characters' categorizations of good and evil, but she also left me pondering the fictional setting of her story, a world that deals with magic in a unique and refreshing way. Things I still wanted to know after finishing. 1. Who is the Harry Potter to Sigrid's Voldemort? Whose antagonist is she? 2. What will she do with her power? 3. What will magical politics be like afterward? 4. Can she decide who's allowed to use the magic reservoir? 5. What did Thomas represent? Perhaps the answers to all my questions don't really matter. What I read was enough to make me genuinely think about what makes a villain. And that's what I wanted from the beginning. The Sea Witch by Marissa Meyer. The razor-sharp barnacles clawed at my fingertips as I strained to wrench them free of the rotting wood. I cursed them repeatedly as I worked, not having known the depths of my hatred for barnacles until this moment. Vicious, stubborn little parasites. Vile, thankless cadgers. It wasn't long before I was also cursing my own feeble muscles and long, ink-black hair that wouldn't stop swimming in front of my face and obscuring my vision. Another barnacle sliced into my palm, and I let out a scream of frustration. Grabbing the whalebone knife from my sack, I lifted the blade over my shoulder with every intention of hacking the nasty creatures to pieces, but I resisted the temptation long enough for the fury to pass. My heart was still thumping, but reason began to return. I needed the barnacles intact, or this wouldn't work. I needed them whole. I drew in a mouthful of salt water, swished it angrily around my cheeks, then forced it out through my teeth. My tail flicked against the side of the long, drowned ship, making a hollow drumming sound that matched my pulse. Eyeing the barnacles, I resolved that I would not be deterred. They were the last ingredient I needed, and I would have them, no matter if they left my fingertips shredded and scarred. After all, what was this temporary pain to a lifetime of bliss? Shoving my drifting hair out of my face, I returned to my work, digging the point of the dagger around the barnacle's edges. I leveraged it against the wood, prying and grunting. The wood began to crumble, and I grasped the edge of a waterlogged plank and pulled hard, bracing my tail against the ship's side. It creaked and groaned and finally released, just as a particularly cruel barnacle sliced through the pad of my thumb. I yanked my hand away with a snarl. Blood blossomed like pearls on my skin before disappearing in the dark water. "That's it," I growled, stabbing at the traitorous barnacle. With a pop, it dislodged and sank down toward the ocean floor. It wasn't as satisfying a death as I would have hoped, but no matter. I had what I'd come for. Opening the sack that bobbed on my shoulder, I stashed the splintered plank of barnacle-infested wood inside. 20 live barnacles, the spell demanded. I had twice that, but I wanted to be sure I had plenty, in case something went wrong and I had to start over. I'd never tried such a complicated spell before, nor had I ever so badly wanted one to work. Needed one to work. That left only one more ingredient to gather. 3 silver scales taken from the tail of the merman I wished to fall in love with me. I still wasn't sure how I would get close enough to Prince Lorindel to cut 3 scales from his tail, but the royal concert was tonight, and he was sure to be there. Surrounded by his horrid entourage, no doubt, but they couldn't spend the entire evening at his side, and I only had to get close enough for a moment. 3 scales. 3 insignificant little scales, and by this time tomorrow, Lorindel would be mine. I shut my eyes, clutching my bag to my chest. Brave Lorindel, who had slain an elusive frilled shark and brought its body back for the entire kingdom to feast on. Kind Lorindel, who had labored beside the working merfolk to build shelters for creatures who had lost their homes in the aftermath of a devastating surface storm. Fair Lorindel, with his cunning, boyish smile. Good Lorindel, who was destined for greatness, who would be king, who would need a queen. I opened my eyes, buoyed by the longing that pulsated beneath my skin. I would be that queen. My tail twisted in the wet sand as I turned away from the ship, shifted the bag on my shoulder, and pushed myself upward. I kept hold of my knife, ever wary of predators, but my thoughts still drifted toward my spell and my prince. I ducked beneath the mast of the ship, which had fallen ages ago, its massive sails long eroded by the water, and was gliding over the ship's bow when a form rose up before me. I cried out and tried to stop, but my momentum carried me straight into the merman's chest. A chuckle vibrated in the water around us. Hands gripped my shoulders, easing me away from him. My heart skittered as I recognized the face, that perfect, beautiful face. Lorindel's mouth was wide and amused, his black eyes locked onto mine, his blonde hair swirling in the current.
"This is a surprise, Neret," he said.
And oh, my name in that voice, a shudder cascaded from my neck to the tip of my tail.
"What are you doing so close to the shallows?"
Nothing, I stammered before amending it to, "just looking." I swallowed hard. His hands were still on my shoulders. He was so close. Never once had he been so close to me, other than perhaps a brief passing in the coral halls of the Sea King's castle. There had never been a reason for him to be so close to me. I was no one.
"Looking for what?"
There was mirth in his expression. His eyes held me in place, as resolute as a barnacle clinging to the body of a ship. I thought of the barnacles in the bag that even now bounced against my side. I thought of the spellbook lying in my cave, the ingredients scrawled out by some ancient hand. I debated if I had any reason to lie, but then, what would I say if not the truth? "Barnacles," I whispered.
"Barnacles?"
His voice had a laugh in it.
"Those mean little suckers? Whatever would you want with them?"
Before I could formulate a logical response, his hands were tracing down my arms, past my elbows, to my wrists, and finally, my fingers. Every gliding touch sent a flurry of tingles across my skin.
"You're hurt," he said,
his brow dipping with sympathy as he lifted my hand. The pad of his thumb traced mine, the tip of his tail brushed against my fin. His tail. He was so close, and I was still holding the knife. But how could I take 3 scales now without him noticing?
"Is this from the barnacles?"
he asked, indicating the wound that had stopped bleeding. I nodded. A sly glint entering his eyes, Lorindel took my thumb into his mouth. I squeaked. His tongue rolled over the tip of my thumb, and a current of desire rocked into me. I dropped the dagger. The bag slipped from my shoulder, sinking toward the deck of the ship. I swayed toward the prince, swooning, yearning.
"I've got it!"
Lorindel jerked back, fast as a skittish triggerfish. Turning his head to one side, he spat, his face blanching.
"Took long enough."
I spun around. Lorindel's 3 closest confidants surrounded us, the twins, Meryl and Murdoch, eagerly flapping their gold-tipped fins, and beautiful, silver-tailed Beldine, the girl who had long been rumored to be Lorindel's future bride. She was holding my sack, already clawing through it while the others watched, smirking. My brain was still fogged from Lorindel's touch, and it was a long, muddied moment before I could grasp the reality. This, all of it, had been a trick, a diversion to get my pack. Mortification burned across my skin.
"Barnacles, just like she said."
Beldine pulled a strip of wood from the pack. "Along with some fish bones, snail shells, and..." She gasped and recoiled. I knew what she had seen before she reached in and pulled out the single octopus tentacle, holding it between her fingertips as if afraid it would bite her.
She threw the tentacle onto the ship's deck and turned a repulsed scowl toward me.
No, you didn't. You witch!
I cringed. Witch was not an insult lightly used. Our elders told tales of sea witches long dead. They were said to be sickly, slimy creatures who fed on fish spines and used their cruel magic to bring misery upon innocent merfolk who stumbled unwittingly into their path.
Neret,
said Lorindel, his previously tender voice now as rough as coral.
Tell me the creature wasn't alive when you took this.
I glanced at him, my jaw unhinged. He looked angry, but also ashamed. Of me? I tried to back away, but the twins were there to stop me, and I had nowhere to go. The truth was that the octopus had been alive when I had taken my blade to one of its 8 legs, holding the beast down with the flat of my palm while I sawed it off. This wasn't my choice, though. It had to be taken alive for the spell to work. My bottom lip began to tremble. I looked from the prince to Beldine, to Merrill, to Murdoch. All of them stared at me with the disgust I'd almost grown used to. Merrill cursed beneath her breath, an odd tinge to her pallor as she looked down at the tentacle. It's just like the seahorses all over again. Of course she would bring up those damned seahorses, hateful girl. It should have been long forgotten, but they refused to forget. It was one of my earliest attempts to perform a spell from the old books, and I had required a ring of seahorses strung together in a protective circle. I had hunted down 50 of the tiny creatures, and ever so carefully pushed a needle through each of their spiraled tails, pulling the string through their flesh one by one. It was only a small wound. It wouldn't have killed them, and the spell would have given me the ability to command schools of fish. For weeks I had dreamed of my own personal entourage of butterfly fish that would follow me everywhere I went. There were days when I still dreamed of it. It would have worked, too, if Beldine hadn't found me, 30 seahorses in, and started shrieking as though she'd just seen a murder. Lorindel and the twins had not been far behind, and Lorindel had forced me to release the creatures. And the looks they had given me, the look he had given me. That was the moment I realized I was different from them somehow, and Lorindel's sneer spoke plainly that my differences were not endearing. In fact, my interest in long-forgotten magic was barely above tolerable. I feigned indifference, and over time that indifference became a well-crafted shell. For years I pitied those around me, those who were not enlightened to the possibilities of enchantment, those who would live their trivial lives and die without knowing what it was like to undo a piece of the world and weave it into something new. I mocked the insignificant worries of my peers. I judged their silly gossip and believed myself above them all. But I was a fool. For all the time I'd spent with my condescension, I could yet find no fault with Prince Lorindel. Years had passed. I was more alone than ever, and now I was desperately, agonizingly in love.
You're sick, said the boy twin, Murdoch, lowering his face toward mine.
I backed away, but he persisted.
You should be cast out with the bottom feeders before your foul blood poisons the rest of us.
No, I stammered. I didn't do anything. That tentacle wasn't... It was... I just found it.
You're lying.
Lorindel rounded on me, drawing closer until he was all I could see, as close as he'd been before. But this time, I found myself shrinking back, searching for a way to escape the gaze that burrowed into my skin.
That was a beast of my father's kingdom, of my kingdom, and you mutilated it. And for what? A silly spell in some book?
My heartbeat quickened, racing now. All my nerves teemed with the desire to flee, but I couldn't move, not even to escape Lorindel's wrath. Even now, I found myself hoping that I could make him see that I had no other choice. He must know that I had to do it, that I had loved him for so very long, that anyone would have gone to such lengths. But my thoughts stumbled and finally halted. He knew. He knew about the spell. They all knew. How? I whispered. How do you know?
We saw you leaving your cave this morning, said Murdoch, and thought we'd take a look around.
Merrill folded her arms over her chest. Always been curious to know what you do in that creepy place, all alone every day. We found your morbid collection, all those macabre little trinkets. And then we found the book, said Beldine, gliding closer to me. Conveniently left open to a spell meant to force someone into falling in love. She clicked her tongue. You shouldn't have written Lorindel's name on the pages, sweet Narret. It made it all a bit too easy to figure out. I turned to the prince, pleading. I meant no harm. I only thought... I'd hoped that if I could... My chest felt as if it would cave in as I appealed to Lorindel, reaching for his hands, but he pulled away before I could touch him. Please, Your Highness, you don't understand. I love you. I always have. I would do anything.
Then hold your tongue, and you will never speak to me again. You disgust me.
His eyes narrowed, lacking any hint of pity.
I order you to leave my sight before I'm sick to my stomach.
As a sob quaked through my body, I turned and fled. I swam as hard as I could go, my cries swallowed up by the sea. I had only one place to go, only one place that had ever felt like solace in a kingdom where everyone hated me, had always hated me, where no one even tried to see beneath my shell and understand how I wanted to be one of them. I wanted to belong. But when I arrived at the entrance to my cave, I drew up short. They had destroyed it. Clay pots were shattered on the floor. Squid ink had been smeared over my artwork and notes. Skulls and bones and fossils were left broken and scattered in the sand. No longer a sanctuary, this felt more like a tomb. With a wail of agony, I turned and swam upward instead. I lay sprawled on the sandy shore, staring at a dark sky that swirled with gems. I had been shivering for hours, my teeth chattering with every gust of wind, but I liked the cold. It was numbing, and the breeze had dried my skin, leaving rough trails of salt over my body. Lorindel hated me. For years I had imagined myself invisible to him, and I had hoped the spell would change that. I had dreamed so many times of the day, that moment, when his eyes would pass over the crowd and find me. More brilliant and deserving than any other mermaid in the kingdom. I had known we were meant to be together. I had believed it down to my bones. But I could no longer deny the truth. I was not invisible to him. I was contemptible. I decided then, staring at the stars, that I would never again return to the sea. I would die here on this shore, cold and alone. Perhaps I deserved it. Surely I didn't deserve to be loved, for otherwise wouldn't I have found someone to love me by now? Yes, this would be the fate of poor, pathetic Narret. Perhaps a human fisherman would someday find my bones whitened in the sun, and I would become a legend. It was a better fate than any that awaited me beneath the waves.
Hello? Miss?
I gasped and jerked upward, spinning my body around to see a human male picking his way over the driftwood and scattered stones. My hair prickled. The man paused when he took in my expression.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to startle you. To be honest, I wasn't sure if you were a girl or a seal. You were lying so still, I thought maybe you were hurt.
He moved closer, stepping over a large piece of driftwood.
Are you...
His question trailed off as his eyes swept down my body. I didn't know if he noticed my nakedness first or my long tail, but either way, he froze. His eyes widened. I turned and began to scurry down the beach toward the waves. The tide had gone out while I'd lain there, and the ocean was much farther away than I'd thought, but my arms and tail were strong as they propelled me across the sand.
No, wait!
I paused. I didn't know why. I knew that I shouldn't. Every story I'd ever heard of man told me to escape into the water and never look back. Perhaps I was not so keen to die on this beach as I'd thought. Maybe it was my broken heart, or some part of me that was enchanted by the idea of this being, this man, calling for me, wanting me to stay. This man who didn't know me, and therefore could not yet despise me. I licked my lips and looked back over my shoulder. He hadn't moved. His hands were out, perhaps in an effort to keep from frightening me any more than could be helped. In the faint moonlight, I could tell he was not beautiful, but neither was he unfortunate to look on. He was of slight build, with dark hair cut short and a rather pointy nose, almost beak-like. When he smiled, though, he had a pronounced dimple in his left cheek that was very nearly charming. He was smiling now. I swallowed. "Hello," he said, barely above a whisper, as if to be louder would startle me away. And perhaps it would. My fingers were still burrowing into the sand. My tail was a twitch away from pushing me the last length into the water.
"My name is Samuel," he said, taking one step closer.
When I did not move, he dared to take another.
"And you are a dream sprang to life."
His gaze slipped down to my tail again, one curious, rapturous look.
"And you're beautiful."
The compliment struck my heart as fast and sharp as a hunter's harpoon. His stunned gaze found mine again, and he seemed to grow bashful. His attention dipped to the sand, then to me, out to the ocean, and back to me.
"I'm sorry," he said. "You probably have no idea what I'm saying. Can you speak? Do your kind have a language? I wonder if maybe..."
"I understand you." His eyes widened again. "My name is Neret." He stared at me for such a long time that I thought maybe he had forgotten there were ocean and stars and sand at all. Maybe he had forgotten all the world but for me. It was the first time anyone had looked at me like that. Samuel eased himself down into the sand and smiled his warm, dimpled smile. Then he asked me to tell him all about the world beneath the sea. I came to the same beach every night after that, and always Samuel was waiting for me. We were both shy at first, nervous and bumbling, but soon talking to Samuel became as natural as swimming through the salt-heavy waters. We would stretch out beside each other, and I would be hypnotized by the cadences of his voice. I loved to listen to him. I loved how he hardened his consonants and drawled his vowels. I loved the stories he told. Tales of sailors lost at sea who came back telling of merfolk and sirens. He told me of the townspeople who laughed at them, and those who believed. He told me of wars fought in distant lands, and gods who were loved, and gods who were feared, and how his favorite sound was church bells on Sunday afternoons, and how his favorite food was something called bread coated with sweet butter and sticky marmalade. My mouth watered when he tried to describe them, though I couldn't begin to imagine these foreign flavors. He told me how he had once had a sweetheart, but she had married a man who wasn't poor like he was, and how he had spent the last 3 years of his life trying to be happy for her. Weeks passed before Samuel dared to touch me. A brush of fingers through the tips of my drying hair, then a knuckle against my shoulder. He never touched my tail, though he often stared at it with mystified awe.
"You must be beloved," he said one night, a month after our first meeting. "You must be admired and doted upon by all your brethren in the sea."
A laugh escaped me before I could stop it. Samuel cocked his head and furrowed his brow in a way that was adorably human. I considered lying. I was pleased by the idea that Samuel saw me that way, beloved, and I didn't want to destroy such a perception. But I couldn't lie to him, not after he had told me so many truths. "No, Samuel, I am not well-liked by my kind." Samuel frowned.
"How can that be?"
"They think I'm strange. My whole life I've been shunned, mocked for my talents, and pushed away." I swallowed hard and forced my tongue to still, worried I'd said too much. Would Samuel begin searching for the reason now? Would he, too, begin to see whatever horrible traits the others saw in me? A hand pressed into my lower back, just above where skin met scales. I sucked in a surprised breath and dared to raise my eyes. Samuel was closer now, his eyes full of sympathy and kindness. It was baffling to me that I had ever looked at him and not thought him handsome. Now I was certain he was the most beautiful creature in this world.
"They are jealous,"
he whispered.
They are blind fools who cannot see the treasure before them.
He kissed me. His lips were gentle, but the kiss was roughened by the salt on my mouth. He pulled away with a sigh.
You are the sea,
he murmured.
I love you,
I murmured back. Fear quickly tightened around my chest, and I wished that I could pull the words back into my mouth, but Samuel's grin widened. He took my hands into his.
My lovely Neret, I must go away.
The dread that struck me at these words was immediate and painful. I had been too rash. I had ruined everything. But he continued.
But I will return on the night of the next full moon. I want to find a way for you and me to be together, some means that will allow you to be by my side forever, so we may never again be parted. I hope this is what you want also?
Weak, tenuous joy trembled in my chest.
Yes, I said. I want this also.
Then I will find a way, my darling. Will you promise to be here when I return?
My heart was pounding, my pulse running as hot as if I had his human blood in my veins. I nodded and did not shy away when he kissed me again. I returned to my cave for the first time in weeks. It was just as I had left it, all destruction and mayhem, but no longer did the sight fill me with agony. No, now there was only willful determination. 2 weeks. I had 2 weeks before I saw Samuel again, and I knew what I would do. I loved him for his optimism, for his belief that he might be able to find a way for us to be together, but I knew he would never find such a way, not unless his human witches had magic like we had beneath the sea. No. If we were to be together, it would be my doing. I began to search for the book, digging through the scattered bones and skulls, shoving aside piles of lobster claws and abalone shells, pulling curtains of kelp and seaweed away from the dark basins where hot air erupted up from the earth below. I found the book beneath a crush of broken bottles and sea glass, half sunken in sand. As I wiped the mud off the giant clamshell pages, it became clear that some of the spells were missing. I flipped through them hurriedly. Ah, the love potion. Of course. No matter. I no longer wanted the love of Prince Lorindel. I no longer needed to trick anyone into loving me at all. My heart raced as I searched for the spell that I did need. The shells clacked as I turned through them again, skimming through the book once, then twice. There, a spell carved into the pearlescent pages by some sorceress of ages ago. The spell that would turn my fish's tail into a pair of human legs. I read through the ingredients. The skins and organs of water snakes, the spinal cord of a sea otter, fish eyes and squid tentacles, and a single black pearl. Blood given willingly from a merfolk's chest. All ingredients that could be harvested easily enough. Then I began to read through the warnings, for where there was magic, there was danger. Upon drinking the elixir, it will be as if a sword were cutting through the merfolk's stomach. Once transformed, the merfolk will maintain all manner of grace, though each step taken upon these legs will be as an abomination walks, and it will be as though daggers were being thrust into the soles of these human feet. Let it forthwith also be known that if a merfolk sacrifices their natural life in pursuit of a land-dweller's love, then only through marriage may they obtain an immortal soul and a share of man's happiness. If that human should rather choose to marry another, then at the sun's first light following the marital vows, the merfolk will perish and become naught but foam on the crest of the ocean's waves. This fate can be eluded if the merfolk chooses instead to take the human's life before sun's first light. This shall be done by plunging a dagger of carved bone into the heart of the human who once was loved. By this act, the merfolk will once more become a creature of the sea, and never more will they be permitted to venture to the world of man. I read the warnings with interest, if not fear. Surely Samuel would marry me, and we would be joyful together for eternity, but I did not relish the thought of feeling as though a sword were cutting through my stomach, or daggers were being thrust into the soles of my human feet. Imagining it made me feel faint, but I thought of Samuel and his kiss and resolved myself. After all, what was a lifetime of pain when coupled with a lifetime of bliss? I set aside the book of spells and began to gather my ingredients. 2 weeks was a long time to wait, an eternity to wait. But when Samuel returned for me, I would forever leave this miserable ocean behind. The elixir was black as squid ink, though when it caught the light, it shone as if a sky full of stars were captured inside. I used my dagger, recovered from the ship's wreckage, to scoop the pasty liquid into an empty snail shell and tried not to imagine it sticking to my throat as I drank. Trying not to imagine anything beyond Samuel's arms around me. Clutching the shell in one fist and my knife in the other, I took one last turn around my cave. I had done little to clean it up. There was no point. I would never see it again, and even now I felt no sadness at its loss. There was nothing to miss, no one to say goodbye to. I flicked my tail, pushing myself toward the surface. The moon was drooping near the horizon when I burst out of the waves. It was as bright and round as the gem on the Sea King's scepter, and the water around me was alive with green, glowing algae. It was a perfect evening to be ashore. I swam to the beach, my stomach feeling as if I had swallowed an entire school of herring. Samuel wasn't there yet, which was for the best. I didn't want him to witness my pain as the spell undid my body and wove it back together. Setting the knife on a rock, I cradled the shell in both hands. I looked into the swirling, inky liquid, then down at the tail that was not as strong or graceful as some of the other merfolk's, but that I had always thought a fine sort of tail. Fine or not, it was keeping me from being with Samuel. I tilted the shell against my lips and drank. No sooner had the elixir slipped down my throat than I felt a stab of pain cutting through my belly. I gasped and reached for my stomach, certain that I would find a blade buried in my flesh, but there was nothing there. The pain continued, searing through my guts until I was sure I was being turned inside out. I screamed in agony and collapsed. It was with much effort that I opened my eyes again. The world was bleary. Dried salt had tangled my lashes together. My heart was throbbing, my blood a chaotic rush through my ears. I gasped for air. It tasted different, colder, crisper. It was still night, but the moon had trekked halfway across the sky. Storm clouds were on the horizon, threatening to reach land within the hour. There would be no sun tomorrow, my first day as human. I bolted upright. Human. My jaw fell as I took in my body. Somehow, the absence of my tail was more shocking than the addition of human legs. I traced my shaking hands down my pale thighs, over the hard shins, to the toes that curled on my command, as obedient as my fins had once been. A cry of elation escaped me. I was human. I rolled onto my side and moved to stand, but as I put my weight onto my feet for the first time, I yelped and my legs buckled, hurtling me back to the sand. The pain was furious. Not as horrible as when I had first tasted the elixir, but enough to leave me whimpering when I thought of standing again. I had to, though, for Samuel, for our future together. Gritting my teeth, I tried again, and this time I succeeded, locking my knees to hold my body upright. It was as if I stood on needles. I hissed, my face scrunched against tears. It was tolerable, I told myself. I would tolerate it. I took a step, flinched, stepped again. The pain did not lessen, but through strength of will I kept myself moving forward. I was walking. It was painful, but it would not kill me. I could go on, and so I would. Soon Samuel would be here. He would embrace me and give me his arm, and what would pain be then? Nothing but an annoyance buried beneath my elation. With this thought, I heard him. I turned toward the footsteps coming down the beach. I spotted him before he spotted me, and my body lightened, my heart soaring on the feathers of a white-winged tern. He was just as I remembered him,
moving among the driftwood with an eager gait, picking his way among the broken shells and stringy kelp. He looked up, beaming.
Narrett, you're here.
He halted, his smile deadening as he realized that I was not lying on the sand waiting for him. His expression slackened as he took in my body, all bare skin and uncertain legs. I had never been embarrassed by my nakedness before, but suddenly I felt vulnerable standing before him. I swallowed, believing it must be the newness of my strange body, but I could not keep from wrapping my arms around myself.
Samuel,
I breathed. I wanted him to grin again. I wanted him to scoop me into his arms and laugh with glee at my unexpected transformation. He did none of those things. He seemed stunned and, after a long moment, horrified.
"What did you do?"
he asked, nay, demanded. My smile became strained.
I've made it possible,
I said, daring a painful step forward.
I've made it so we can be together, like we wanted. After this night, we will never have to be parted, just like you said.
No, this can't be.
He stepped back even as I came nearer. His hands went to his head, burying his fingers in his hair until it stuck out at all angles.
No, no, no! Samuel, what?
A shrill whistle sent a cascade of ice down my spine, followed by a male voice that I didn't recognize.
She is a beauty, I'll afford you that.
I looked up and spotted a pair of men standing on the nearest dune. They held an assortment of chains between them. The man who had spoken shook his head.
But I don't see any fish's tail. Where is the mermaid, Sam?
She was a mermaid, I swear.
Samuel gestured toward my body with dismay.
I don't understand. This is some dark magic. She must be a witch. Take her as a witch.
I stumbled backward.
Samuel, what's going on? Who are these men?
We have a witch already,
said the second stranger.
Vladlena, with the all-seeing third eye. But if this girl needs a job, I think we can come up with something for her to do,
the first man said with a hideous smirk.
Fisker and Holt's traveling circus is always looking for offstage talent. Will save us from having to build that saltwater tank, too.
He took a step closer to the edge of the dune, and I noticed something that had been hidden from my sight before. A harpoon. I whimpered, beginning to understand that Samuel had brought these men, that he had told them about me, that he had... What? What had he done?
Samuel?
His eyes flashed.
You, he said, snarling, were going to make me rich. 1,000 guilders they would have paid me, and now you're worthless.
He threw an angry gesture toward my legs.
Nah, said one of the men. I wouldn't say that. We'll find a use for her. Don't you worry.
I heard the telltale sounds of sand and rocks slipping down the embankment, but before the men could reach me, I snatched my forgotten knife from the ground and fled into the sea. I swam as hard as I could until my limbs burned and I was cursing my pathetic human legs. I swam until I could no longer see the shore. I didn't know if Samuel or either of the men chased after me. If they did, they must have given up once the storm arrived. I was soon caught up in thrashing water and torrential rain, and I became sure that I was dying. I welcomed death, even, sure it would be less painful than the heart that was ripped to pieces in my chest. I didn't know how long I stayed bobbing among the waves, so much colder now than they had felt before. My teeth were chattering, and the current battered my body. By the time it dragged me ashore, bedraggled and famished, the shreds of my heart had already begun to stitch themselves into something angry and vengeful. I remember little about those first days. I stole what clothes I could from the lines in a small fishing village, and scavenged for mussels and urchins on the beach like nothing more dignified than a common gull. Days turned into weeks, and I grew braver, sometimes leaving my cold beach coves to wander the village alleyways. When the humans did not chase me away with sharp sticks and stones, I grew bolder still. I drifted through their markets and slipped away with carrots and cucumbers when I could.
Weeks gave way to months. I learned of money and took to begging for the hard, round coins that could buy sustenance. I learned what bread was, though butter and marmalade never crossed my palate. I watched the other women and took to combing my hair and styling it off my neck as they did. Months gave way to years. I watched. I listened. I moved from village to town to city, though could never stand to be too far from the sea. For listening to the lulling hush of the waves at night was the only way I could capture any sleep. I took a job at a shop that sold dried herbs and medicines. I was a natural alchemist, the owner told me once, watching me grind tarragon leaves into a paste. I did everything with anger. I waited. I waited for my death, because I knew that someday even abhorrent Samuel would find a woman to be his wife, and on the morning after their wedding, my life would be stolen from me. I had no fear of dying, but neither did I long for it. My life was fueled by hatred, and I waited for a chance, any chance I might have, to seek vengeance on the man who had betrayed my heart, who had stolen my eternity. Then, one afternoon, as I stood outside the shop smashing blue juniper berries with my knife handle, I saw him. He was with a girl, a lady with perfect yellow curls. I watched them from across the street, elbows linked, lovers' smiles. Samuel turned and looked at me, directly at me, and there was not even a hint of recognition. My heart stilled, encrusted with every moment of agony I had endured since our last meeting. I set down the berries and followed them. I found his house. I asked questions. I learned that they were engaged and that the wedding was mere days away. I watched. I waited. I did everything with anger. I did not attend Samuel's wedding, though I could envision his carefree, dimpled smile as he said the vows that should have been mine. I could envision his pretty, innocent bride. I had learned that she came from a family with some affluence, and no doubt Samuel was pleased that his charm had won him the wealth he'd longed for. No, I did not go to the wedding. Instead, I went to the home he would soon share with his wife, and waited there with the reassuring weight of my dagger in my fist, the spell book's warnings echoing in my head. It was late when the bride and bridegroom finally retired to the bedchamber, full of boisterous laughter from too much wine. It was not long before their cheer died down into even, drowsy breathing. I emerged from my hiding space and went to stand over the bed. The girl was pretty enough, captured in the light that filtered through their lace curtains, but I had eyes only for her groom. Samuel. How had I ever thought him beautiful? My grip tightened on the dagger's handle. The bone seemed warm, almost alive in my hand. I considered waking Samuel so he might know my face one last time, so he might understand it was I who was robbing him of his joy, as he had once robbed me of mine. I wanted him to see my eyes and to know it was his own heartless betrayal that had murdered him. But I worried that he might overpower me if he was awake, even in his drunken stupor, and I would not let anything keep me from taking his life this night. I had waited far too long. I anchored one leg against the mattress and raised the knife. I watched Samuel's chest rise with a breath and sink again. Rise and sink. Rise and... I plunged the blade into his heart. His eyes snapped open. His mouth parted in a silent scream. The girl, too, awoke, but her scream was not silent. Blood was already on the sheets and on my hands, and I was smiling. No, I had started to laugh, though the sound was drowned out by the hysterical bride. I laughed because Samuel was looking at me, and this time I knew that he remembered. I abandoned my blade in his chest and ran. The streets were empty. I had long grown accustomed to the pain in my feet, and it didn't hinder my speed as I ran. I knew the moment Samuel died, because I collapsed there on the cobbled street and felt the pain of a sword once more cutting through my gut. This time, I refused to swoon. I swallowed my screams and kept pushing forward, crawling on my elbows, dragging my useless legs behind me until they had stitched together and melded once more into a fish's tail. It no longer felt agile and strong, but rather like a clumsy weight tied to my body, which had to be dragged across the ground. Rocks and glass tore into my flesh. My muscles burned. I crawled all the way back to the ocean. The water called to me, giving me strength, and when I finally reached the surf, it welcomed me, engulfed me, beckoned me to come back home. Home. I had thought I would never return, but there was no sorrow in my heart as I started swimming toward the castle of the Sea King. I was once again a creature of the ocean, and I was going home. A smile rose on my face, and I looked adoringly down at my body, reformed. My eyes widened. I froze and cried out, but the sound was lost in a flurry of bubbles that raced back to the surface. Twice, magic had undone my body and woven my flesh back together, leaving me forever changed. I was no longer looking at the sleek, graceful tail of the merfolk, but rather the dark, oily body of a serpent.
"You are no longer one of us," Lorindel said,
one lip curled with disgust as he inspected my serpentine body.
"You do not belong here, Neret."
All around the crystal throne room, merfolk tittered at Lorindel's spite and my chastisement. In my absence, the old king had died, and Lorindel had ascended to his throne. Predictably, he had taken Beldine for his wife. She sat beside him nursing a newborn child, their sixth daughter, I was told. I tightened my hands into angry fists. I yearned to scream at him, to tell him that this was the only place I could possibly belong. But then, no. Maybe I had never belonged here at all. And maybe this was his fault, and those like him. Those whose minds were too small to appreciate my talents. Those who had treated me as an outcast long before they had cause to. "Where would you have me go, Your Majesty?" I asked with no effort to mask my derision. "For you say I do not belong in your kingdom beneath the sea, yet I do not belong to the world above either." Lorindel snarled.
"Where you go is not my concern. You are an abomination and a disgrace. I will not have you sullying my kingdom with your presence. If my people choose to seek you out for your dark talents, I cannot stop them, but I will take no part of it. From henceforth, you are not welcome here."
Not welcome here. Fury burned in my chest, clawing its way to the surface of my skin. Who was this man to decide where I was or was not welcome? Who was he to belittle what I had gone through, the suffering I had endured, when he could have prevented all of it with nothing more than a smile and a word of kindness? Not just Lorindel, all of them. Samuel and Beldine and the entire kingdom and the entire world. They had all shunned me, belittled my work, mocked my dreams, betrayed my heart. There was no kindness to be found here. Not for poor, pathetic Neret. I narrowed my eyes, and my gaze drifted back to the newborn child. She was wrapped in a seal-pelt blanket. A shining tail swished drowsily, prettily from the swaddling. I turned my attention back to the Sea King, a smile sharpening over my teeth. "Cast me out, then, if that is what you wish. For you are right, oh, my wise king. Once they know what I can do, your people will seek me out for my dark talents, the innocent ones and the desperate ones. And help they shall receive, though great misery will come to all who do not heed the warnings of my terrible magic. My own misery is proof enough of that." I turned away. The gathered merfolk parted to let me pass, their eyes following me with wary distrust. This time, for the first time, they had every reason to be frightened of me. I was the stuff of their childhood nightmares, after all. Those sickly, slimy creatures that lurked in the depths, drunk on their own wickedness. Never mind their fear. They would still come, those innocent, desperate fools. They would come to me for gifts and blessings and curses. They would come for poisons and cures, and I would fulfill their wishes and deliver to them their miserable fates, as my fate had been delivered to me. I was an abomination, undone and rewoven back together. I was the Sea Witch. Zoe Hertz Villain Challenge to Marissa Meyer.
What if the Sea Witch had previously been in the Little Mermaid's shoes, but decided to kill the love interest and turn back into a mermaid instead? Villain or Hero? You decide. By Zoe Hurt. I've been thinking about our villain, Nerit. She faced life-altering decisions every step of the way, when her love potion plot was outed, when she fell in love with Samuel, and when she left her kingdom for the very last time. She chose to take her life in her own hands rather than blindly follow the norms of her society out of fear. Even though it cannot be said that Nerit made the kindest choices, I mean, she did murder someone, she always stuck to her own beliefs, and that is admirable. We all dream about doing something larger than life. The difference between the hero and the villain is that the villain always takes that dream and forcibly tries to make it into a reality, no matter the obstacles in the way. Nerit dreamed about being loved by someone who was as equally unashamed of her as she was of herself. When the opportunity arose twice, with both Lorindel and Samuel, she went against moral and social conventions to try to make it come true, performing powerful and illegal magic that could, and did, result in morally questionable consequences. Nerit didn't focus on the cons, however, as she had faith in her own talents and was willing to go to the ends of the earth to get what she wanted. Say what you want about her, but Nerit is fearless. Now, I think I'm a relatively good person. I break for squirrels that run into the street, and I'm proud to say I've never cheated on any of my school tests, though that's not to say I've never given the latter much thought. While staring down at a blank Scantron sheet during an AP calculus test that I was totally unprepared for, you bet I was dreaming of how great it would be to sneak a little peek at the test of the student next to me. She was flying through those questions with ease, and the right answers were there for the plucking. The problem is, I am a coward. Despite how desperately I needed those answers, I could not and would not dare try that sneaky maneuver. I just knew in every fiber of my being that the moment I turned my eyes even a fraction of an inch to the left, my teacher would pounce on me, and that would be it. I would be thrown out of school and forced to live a wandering life on the streets, out of work, because who in their right minds would hire a 17-year-old who can't solve a simple derivative? Oh, and on top of that, it was wrong. Against the rules. And did I say wrong? Okay, that might be a tad dramatic, but honestly, that's what passes through my mind every time I toy around with the idea of doing something bad. My focus always jumps immediately to the consequences, usually over-dramatizing them to the point that I believe this one decision, no matter how small, will dictate how the rest of my life plays out. I then decide that it's better to play it safe and do the right thing, rather than follow that inner voice that tempts me to take the other path. Are you like Nerit? Find out if you are a hero or a villain with this quiz. What would you do? 1. You are traveling on a path when you pass an old woman begging for food. She looks hungry, but you have only a small loaf of bread and need something to eat for the next day of your journey. You, A, keep it for yourself. You need the food for energy, and you're sure someone else will come by with food for her. B. Give the old woman your food. You don't know how long she's been without food, and you can find something when you get to your destination. 2. After your teacher leaves the room, you notice that the answer sheet for the next test is sitting on the edge of her desk. You, A. Take a look. If your teacher didn't want you to see it, why did she leave it in plain sight? B. Close your eyes and flip it over. You and your classmates will pass or fail on your own. 3. You are offered the opportunity of a lifetime. Unfortunately, if you take it, you will hurt your friend's feelings. You, A. Take it. These opportunities don't come around every day, and your friend will understand. If they don't, were you ever really friends? B. Turn it down. Friendship is more important than any opportunity. What's success without someone to share it with, right? 4. While you are walking, you stumble upon an ancient spell book that teaches powerful dark magic. You, A, read it. You might not use it, but it's good to know, just in case. B, give it to the proper authorities so they can destroy it. No one should have access to something this dangerous. 5. Like Narret, your true love, or so you thought, betrayed you after you risked your entire life to be with him or her. You, A, return.